judge. And this gets to be really a problem as what happened last year in the John Day Basin, where we had a tuberculosis outbreak in a domestic elk herd. But the department, thinking that perhaps it spread to the wild herds nearby, and there's a nearby wintering range there, we were planning to go up in an aircraft and actually kill some of the wild elk so we could assess whether or not disease had spread to them or not. And at the last minute, after conferring with our justice attorneys, they told us because of the way this statute is written that we're here today to hope to fix, that we had a problem and could not go up in the air. Now, as it turned out, after working on the ground later on and assessing some of the hunter kills and everything else, we found that the tuberculosis had not spread. But in other states with diseases out there now like chronic wasting disease and others, more and more necessary for the department to have the ability to use aircraft in big game management. And that's why we're here today. I'll let Mr. Anglin carry any details to fill in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator with ODFW. What we've looked at in coming up with language on this and through the amendments is how do we go about addressing some of the situations that we could potentially find ourselves in that we feel that this would be a tool that we really need as an agency. And we've identified through time several major categories that we feel are important to us as an agency, namely scientific research and then in some emergency situations to protect human safety, wildlife species, or property. And these are all activities that in the past, that, like Mr. Ellicker said, we felt that we had the authority to do, but the recent interpretations have led us to believe otherwise. And allowing the use of the aircraft will allow us to transmit from the research standpoint, transmit from the air to people on the ground for us to capture animals. Currently, the way the law is written, we are not able to do that. We could go ahead and use it like we've done in the past, where we've had some specific examples where bighorn sheep have left some of their traditional herd ranges and mingled with domestic sheep. We have a real concern about transmission of pastorella from domestics to the wild bighorns, and we've discovered that in the past, if the wild sheep end up going back to their herd, that we can have a pastorella outbreak that results in a complete loss of the herd. So we have utilized aircraft in the past when we know that there are some rams, it's usually young rams that have wandered, and that they're in with some domestic sheep, that we can go in and selectively remove those young rams. And usually it's most effective from the air. It ends up being in some remote areas that you can't always get in from the ground to be able to reach and conduct this work. Also, right now, with some of the concerns and threats with chronic wasting disease, one of the primary tools that's been identified by the International Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies is also to, in some cases, have aircraft available that are used to selectively herd or cull herds in some really drastic situations. Hopefully it's something that would never happen in this state, but again, this would be a tool that would be potentially available to us. And as Mr. Ellicker just stated, the real concern with potential spread of TB from domestically raised elk to the wild, and the real concern there is that if that in fact had happened, and as those elk left the winter range and went back to the summer range and mingled with other elk that were coming in from other winter ranges, that all of a sudden the TB could spread over a fairly large area, and those animals also intermingle with livestock on summer ranges and on winter ranges, and the potential there of transmitting TB into livestock. So we had some real concerns there that this would help us to alleviate some of those potential problems. And that's all I had for testimony, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Roy? In the Dash 3 amendments, what would ODFW do in trying to protect property? I mean, understand to protect human safety, wildlife, wildlife species, property. I just want a little more kind of thinking or definition to that this morning on record, if that's okay with you.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I'm going to let Ron Anglin handle that question.
Mr. Chair, the specific instances would be, again, if we had a disease that's transmissible from wildlife to domestic livestock, the potential to go in and remove those wildlife animals to prevent that transmission and the impacts to domestic livestock. There would also be the ability that if we had, and we've had this occur in the past, where there's been some domestic sheep lost to cougar damage complaints, and we had a cougar in the area that we had radio collars on, we were able to go up in the air and determine that our cat was, in fact, the research cat was nowhere near the area. If it would have been, it would have allowed us then to go in on the ground and determine if that cat was responsible for the damage situation, remove that cat. So it's a very, very remote type situation that we would use this type of tool. Like I said earlier, I can only think in the past where we, you know, a dozen times in the last 5 to 10 years that we've had to use this. But when you need it right now. You don't have the ability to sit back and look at all the other options because you may not have those available.
Okay.
Sure.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. On that note, would property include trees for timber companies and if bears are damaging trees?
I can't bear the discussion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, it probably would be covered under this statute that you could use it. However, whether it would be effective or not, I'd be really reluctant to say that it would be one of the best tools available for private timber damage to solve their problems. All the work that we do from the air and seeing bears or cougars in particular from an aircraft has been extremely rare. And I think that the activities under the damage statutes that they use now to control bear damage, where they can selectively remove animals within the problem area, would probably be a whole awful lot more cost-effective and selective than using aircraft. But I think that, yes, it would be available if the statute were to pass.
I think what he said, Mr. Chair, is that it's hard to shoot bears through the forest from up in an airplane. God. Jesus.
Yes.
Thank you. Line 4 and 5, the word necessary. How are you ever going to prove that it's necessary to use aircraft?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, as you can see from small b, the Fish and Wildlife Commission is going to define emergency situations as necessary. But I guess from my standpoint, the word necessary in the context here to us.
Well, the dictionary defines necessary. We know what necessary means.
Right.
How are you ever going to prove that it's necessary to use an aircraft?
Well, I guess my sense, Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, is that the Fish and Wildlife Commission will define necessary. And to me, necessary probably means you go through a range of options, and then at some point, it's necessary. In other words, for us, always remember that using airplanes or helicopters for game management is very costly. Right now, helicopters are $600 an hour for us on big game management. And we don't do it ourselves. We don't have our own people fly it. It's too dangerous, frankly. You have to hire special crews a lot of times on big game management issues. So my sense would be you go through a range of options, and at some point, it's necessary to go to an aircraft. But after you go through some probably much more cost-effective or local treatments.
I would argue that you are never going to be able to, in the same group that wanted that word in there is going to go in and fight you every step of the way and say it is never necessary to use an aircraft. One more than a different.
Go ahead.
Your sub 5 here in this has got to be one of the most ridiculous inclusions in the statute I've ever seen in my short career as a legislator. I mean, that's like saying if something happens at some point in time that we have no idea, we're taking an animal that doesn't even exist in the state. We're saying if that ever is defined as a game animal, I mean, the wolf does not even exist in Oregon, isn't that correct?
That's, Mr. Chair, Senator Barr, that's essentially correct, yes, sir. There's no wolves here right now that we are aware of.
Why didn't we include grizzly bears? What about grizzly bears? What about California ponders?
Elephants.
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 Gray whales. This is absolutely ridiculous to put that in statute.
And then it's Indian elephants versus African elephants. You never know. They escape.
I'm not asking you to answer that.
I did want to say, Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, as to Section 5, the department does not consider Section 5 in any probability to either change what we do today, since under definition of wolves in Oregon today, they're classified under state law as non-game, and under non-game, we have a right to go up in the air and take wolves or transmit locations of wolves right now, today, and if they were ever moved from the federal list and reclassified as game mammals, this just says that we would have an approved statewide wolf management plan, and frankly, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we're working on a statewide wolf management plan right now and probably would have one before it ever changed the status at all from non-game. So that's the best I can clarify that section for you, sir.
Chair, I'm really concerned about grizzly bears and gray whales. So they've got to be included in this section.
Shall we move on or do we have more? I think you've expressed your opinion fairly well.
I've worked on your game, yeah.
I'm going to move on to hearing testimony from Stephen Kafori, Warren, is it Annie?
Mr. Kafori said he was going to be very brief.
He said he was going to be very brief?
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted you to know that you said that you'd be very brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Senator.
Mr. Kafori, Stephen Kafori from the Wildlife Society Oregon chapter, just very briefly. Wildlife Society is a scientific society of wildlife biologists. We are not an advocacy organization. We are interested in wildlife and wildlife management and try to bring the expertise of professionals to the legislature. And I'll be brief because I'm not one. I have with me one who is.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Warren Aney, and I am a professionally certified senior wildlife ecology, and as Stephen mentioned, I'm addressing House Bill 2209 on behalf of the Oregon chapter of the Wildlife Society. We did submit a written statement to the House committee on this bill, and that should be part of the record, so I'm just going to briefly make a couple of points. One is I have used aircraft for collecting wildlife information, and I have supervised fish and wildlife biologists who have used aircraft. It's a very effective wildlife management tool, and frankly, we were surprised to find out that the department had this limitation on the use of aircraft. I did talk to people in some of our neighboring states, and I found out that they were equally surprised. Other states do allow the use of aircraft for this kind of management and research, and it's really not a question on their behalf. They find it to be a very effective tool. I talked to Idaho, I talked to Wyoming, I talked to Montana, and I also talked to Washington. And so it's not that we're asking for, I think the department is not asking for something unusual. I think the department is just asking for a tool that is in common use elsewhere in this country. Are there any questions?
Any questions? Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate it. You did the most important thing you kept within the parameters of Senator Corcoran's determination of what brief is all about. Is that correct?
Correct.
I'm going to hurry on. Glenn Stonebrink from the Cattlemen's Association is next on the list, and let's call up Al Elkins, too, from Oregon Hunters Association.
Mr. Stonebrink said he was going to be really brief.
Mr. Chair, I'll say it. If Senator Corcoran is willing to vote for the bill now, they better move it quicker, because you got three votes right now, but you might not have three votes in 2 minutes. So.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Al Elkins. Quickly, we support this bill and the Dash 3 amendments, and I have a testimony to hand out from Oregon Guides and Packers, and they also are in support of the Dash 3 amendments.
Glenn?
Glenn Stonebrink for the Oregon Cattlemen Association. We support the bill as a necessary tool for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Service. However, it's interesting in the Dash 3 amendments that it mentions wolves, and we kind of have this thing going on here at the Capitol where we knew that the governor did not want any bill that mentioned wolves, and yet this amendment does. And then it refers to a management plan, and yet in a bill you'll hear soon, House Bill 2468, it talks about changing the definitions in the Oregon Endangered Species Act from management to the word recovery. So that brings in an interesting point. Also, that those of us that represent the livestock industry have worked hard to try to get a bill passed that would do two simple things. Let us protect our families, humans, against any possible wolf attack, and our livestock. And that bill is evidently not going to get a hearing. It shouldn't even have to be a bill. It should be a constitutional right to protect human life and your property from wolf attacks.
This is a bill that we're not hearing?
This is a bill you're not hearing.
Thank you.
Happy to answer any questions. We can't get it here.
Thank you, Glenn. I appreciate your testimony. I'm going to close the hearing and move to a work session on House Bill 2209. Can I have a motion to move the Dash 3 amendments? Senator Corcoran moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2209. Okay. Is there any objection? If there is no objection, the Dash 3 amendments are approved. Now let's move House Bill 2209 as amended by the Dash 3 amendments. Is there such a motion? Senator Corcoran has moved. House Bill 2209 is amended to the floor with a due path recommendation. Any discussion? Would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fisher, Vice Chair
Byer,
aye.
Chair Shields,
aye. The Senate bill, or House Bill 2209, is passed to the floor with a due path recommendation. I'm going to close the work session. The carrier, I guess I'll carry it, just unless we find somebody else. How's that?
Senator Fisher's not here. I think he should do it.
I'll bet.
Senator Fisher, you're just in time, sir. Would you like to carry this fine bill?
Actually, would you like to vote on 2209?
The
Dash. We already approved a Dash 3 without a vote, just without objection. Okay, so Senator Fisher will be recorded as an aye vote. And I'm going to close the work session on 2209. And now we're opening a hearing on House Bill 2468. This is a public hearing.
Shall I walk through it?
Hang on just a minute. I want a chance to catch up with myself here for a minute. Takes a while to dig out from under your own paperwork. Okay.
Not if you're as organized as I am.
Yeah, you just throw it all away, right?
Pretty much.
I understand. I now have... I've opened the hearing. I'm going to ask Judith if she'll talk about 2468 for a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2468A provides the Fish and Wildlife Commission with the authority to waive state Endangered Species Act prohibitions for take in the circumstances of scientific research, prevention of damage, protection of human life, incidental take under an incidental take permit or federal rule, and those actions necessary for the management of the species. It requires the State Endangered Species Act to be consistent with the federal act. It authorizes the commission to remove a species from the list or to choose not to list a proposed species. It requires the commission to consider the status of state-listed threatened and endangered species within 90 days of federal listing removal. It requires the commission to adopt interim protection measures and prioritize recovery efforts and plans no later than July 1, 2008. And it provides for an extension of up to 12 months from that date. You do have at your seat at the dais both the Dash A5 amendments and the hand engrossed version of those amendments. The Dash A5 amendments delete the waiver of the take prohibition of listed species with regard to the necessary management of the species. It adds a waiver of allowing a waiver of the take prohibition in the case of an incidental take not listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act when authorized by commission rule. It requires the commission to base decisions of a waiver of the take prohibitions under the circumstances of, one, a recovery plan, two, interim protection measures in the absence of a recovery plan, or three, survival guidelines for the species developed by the commission prior to the effective date in the absence of both the recovery plan or interim protection measures. It authorizes the commission to place conditions on those waivers in order to minimize the impact on the wildlife taken. It requires the commission then to review prohibition waivers at least annually. The commission also, the amendment deletes the commission's authority to remove from or add to the endangered species list if the species is determined not to be of cultural, scientific, or commercial significance. It deletes provisions that the interim protection measures by rule conserve and protect the species and its habitat pending adoption of the recovery plan, adding back provisions that the interim protection measures by rule ensure instead the survival of the species and the protection of its habitat, again pending the adoption of recovery plans. It continues the effect of survival guidelines adopted by the commission prior to the effective date until the establishment of such interim protection measures. Requires the commission to review the status of recovery plans at least once every 5 years. It directs the commission to prioritize recovery efforts and recovery plans no later than July 1st, 2006. So that's a change from 2008 is moving up to 2006. And finally, the Dash A5 amendments delete language that a person is not prevented from the taking of listed species based on a good faith belief that they're acting to protect a person from bodily harm. It's deleting the phrase based on a good faith belief. So instead it reads that a person is not prevented from taking a listed species if acting to protect persons from bodily harm. We have a fiscal statement on the measure which shows an indeterminate impact. Essentially, the department indicates that it would meet the requirements of the bill and accomplish the work within the specified time by reprioritizing agency resources. Yeah. And I also want to point out we do currently have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this particular measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That was a mouthful. Mm-hmm. I have several folks signed up. Roy Ellerker and Ron England are first on my list again. Could you gentlemen come up and
I don't know why we needed to send a president or a speaker. co-chairs of Ways and Means. They run the damn government.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Roy, thank you for coming back. Thanks for your patience with us this morning.
Sure, I appreciate the opportunity to provide these comments on behalf of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Chair, this bill has undergone quite a bit of negotiation and change, particularly over the last 2 weeks. And it is Representative Bob Jensen's bill, and I understand he's not here today. I guess I'd ask the chair how he'd like me to proceed. I give a general overview of the bill a little bit, but I know that there's a big question as the Dash 5 amendments, and there's a lot of people here to testify to those.
How about you commenting on them first, and that'll maybe set some parameters within which others will be talking, and maybe we can get through this as quickly as possible that way.
To be brief, Mr. Chair, and on my right, Mr. Ron Anglin, again, Wildlife Fish Administrator. Mr. Chair, this bill originated, of course, in the House, Representative Bob Jensen. It's been carefully negotiated and worked through the House with the help of our department and the governor's office. And in particular, the bill is designed for four primary aims: establish more definite goals for the State Endangered Species Act by shifting the focus from conservation to recovery, increase ODF&W's flexibility in granting waivers from the prohibition on take of protected species, make the criteria for listing and delisting species that are currently on the state list consistent, and last, streamline the delisting process by assuring ODF&W authority to delist grandfathered species, grandfathered that is from the federal list when this act arose in 1987, and providing for automatic consideration of delisting species upon delisting of those species by the federal government on the federal ESA list. Now, as to the Dash 5 amendments, I'm going to let Mr. Anglin speak directly to those, sir.
Thank you.
For the record, once again, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. In reviewing the Dash 5 amendments, we feel that it still provides us with the flexibility to work within the Act to accomplish a variety of recovery needs for the state and make the Act work for Oregonians in general. It does put the onus on our commission to define several of the terms that would be included in the Act. It does put the onus on our commission to direct our agency to go ahead and develop a systematic prioritization of the species of most concern, and then to develop recovery plans for those species, working through that priority list. It sets a timeline for establishing that list. And it does give us the ability to deal with the species that were of concern to us and started this discussion, and that's those that were grandfathered on. We currently have no means of removing from the list. So that's a fairly high overview of what those amendments would do. There are some other things within that that we feel we can work around and work with very well. The one concern that has been expressed, and again, it's Representative Jensen's major push, and that's on one of the delisting criteria, and we defer comment on that.
You
defer comment on that.
Okay. Any other comments that you gentlemen want to make?
No, sir.
And there's no questions, so thank you for your time.
Okay.
Stephen Kafori again, and Warren. As they're coming up, I do want you to say, or I do want to say publicly that Representative Jensen has looked at these. He's not happy with them at the moment, but he's not here. He's at a much more significant event. As you know, tragically, a grandson was killed in an accident. So I'm certainly going to take cognizance of that this morning in this hearing. Mr. Kafori?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafori, representing the Oregon chapter of the Wildlife Society. this bill has been a topic of a lot of debate and controversy within this building and also within our organization, and we have conducted an intensive email conversation among members of our organization, and I think we've come up with a consensus internally about what the professional wildlife biologists feel about this bill and the amendments. And I'd let my expert explain what that is.
Yes.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, and again, my name is Warren Haney, professionally certified senior wildlife ecologist and representing the Oregon chapter of the Wildlife Society, which is an organization of about 500 wildlife professionals around the state working for various agencies as consultants and for private industry. Three comments. One is we feel the state does need a clean list of species that it can effectively manage. This will be able to allow it to, in effect, weed out the list and remove some species that it cannot effectively manage. To have a list of species that's long and unnecessarily long, I think, dilutes the significance of the state endangered, threatened, and endangered species list. So it would be a good tool for the agency to be able to, or to have to be able to reduce the size of this list to something that's more meaningful. State agencies also need a waiver to the provision against take or incidental take so they can conduct necessary species and habitat information collection. I have personally been involved in studies for the Oregon Department of Transportation where we were not allowed to do certain things such as wade in a creek where endangered species were present, but when we felt it was necessary to be in that creek to collect necessary species and the habitat information to address the effects of a particular project. If this waiver provision is put in, these things could be on the Department of Transportation could apply for and get a waiver that it would allow it to conduct these kind of necessary activities. We do have a little concern, I think, for we agree that the statement about scientific, cultural, or commercial value it probably doesn't belong in the State Endangered Species Act. However, we also understand the significance of this particular statement to others, and we are concerned, of course, that it could be used to block or promote listing or delisting of a species, depending upon what the question is.
Do you think it moves it from objective to totally subjective? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's right. It throws in non-scientific criteria into the process. However, I think we can certify that all native species are of scientific value. So if you're considering those three factors, I think there will be people coming in and saying that this species, though it may have, for example, negative commercial value, it does have positive scientific value. So there will be those kinds that the department or the commission will be able to weigh and balance those kinds of that kind of information. Are there any questions?
But the subjectivity question is one that bothers you, is what you're saying.
Yes, the subjectivity, the fact that it's not scientific. However, I think we could look the other way and say if it's necessary to pass the bill to have that in there, it's something that could be addressed by maybe at some other time.
Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to ask Glenn Stonebrink and Greg Addington if they would come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We support this bill. We think it's a bill that is necessary for the commission, Fish and Wildlife Commission, to have, because right now they don't have the flexibility to do what common sense should tell them that they could do. The present Oregon Endangered Species Act gives the commission the power to not list. In other words, if someone brings a candidate species forward asking it to be listed, they have the power to not list the species based upon the fact that it is secure outside the state, or the species is not of cultural or not of scientific or not of commercial significance. Now, the bill as written, without it being amended, basically uses the same terminology to say, well, if we could have the power to not list it to begin with, in our review of the status of the species, why wouldn't we use that same language to be able then to remove it? Because presently, you cannot, according to the Attorney General, the Commission cannot remove a species unless it has been significantly recovered. Well, as we've heard in previous testimonies, there are some species that you're not going to be able to do anything. You can't do anything whatsoever to make the species recoverable, and yet we could be forced by court cases to spend a lot of money that we don't have in this state to recover those species. So we think that now the amendment on page would affect the bill on page 4, lines 31 and 32, as mentioned by Ron Anglin, is probably the controversial ones, where it would actually delete and take away the power from the commission to remove the species based on what I just talked about, because they determined that it was not of cultural, scientific, or commercial significance. We don't want that to be a bill killer, but we did want, you know, from the Cattlemen Association, we wanted to say that we still think that that should be part of the bill, and all it does is give that power to the commission to make those decisions, which they presently don't have at this time.
What do you think, Glenn, about this whole conversation I just had with Warren about objectivity versus subjectivity in the lease listing and delisting ends of the... It's an issue of concern to me. I just was interested in your perspective.
Mr. Chairman, it's a good question, and some would even call that as a political decision, but every decision we make is based that way. Very few things can you totally scientifically determine as factual and make a decision on. There's still some subjectivity with people in a position of power, whether it be the legislature or whether it be the commission, based upon all the evidence that's brought forward. And that could still be called a political decision. And as we know, the commissions are, this commission is appointed by the governor, and they could have a political slant to it one way or the other, and depending on the governor, from time to time.
Thank you. Any other questions for Glenn? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greg Addington with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I first want to say we appreciate the involvement of everyone and the work that has been put on this bill. I realize a lot of time and effort has gone into this. Going back to when these amendments came out of the House committee, I had to go to my members and get their opinions on this bill. And there was a lot of concerns at that time. We felt like we were making a big step at that point to specifically, you know, to embrace some of this recovery language. And as ODF&W has said before, you know, we're setting the bar higher by doing this. And our guys, you know, a lot of folks, I think, when they look at they hear about an Endangered Species Act, they automatically think of the federal act. And frankly, our folks don't think of the good things with the federal ESA. I mean, there's a lot of examples of inefficiency and it not working. And so when I go to them and tell them, well, what these amendments do is they set the bar higher in the state, that was a tough pill to swallow. But they also realize that what we have now is basically this statute on the books that isn't doing much of anything. And I think they realize the fact that if we're going to have one, let's have one that works. That means you get put species on, and you have a means to take species off. And so at that point in time, they said to go ahead with the amendments when it came out of the House. And they were pretty specific, saying that if things change, we may not be there. With that being said, I think that, you know, there's been in the last couple of weeks a lot of changes or proposed changes, and we have looked over them and gone both ways on them. And I think, like Glenn said, we don't want this thing to die. We think there are a lot of good things in this bill. But specifically, there is a lot of concern over the deleting of the not of cultural, scientific, or commercial significance to the people of this state. So I guess what I'm trying to say, and I'm not saying it very well, is that I am here to not oppose these amendments. If that makes sense.
I recognize just how enthusiastic that is. Okay.
And we recognize the fact that the situation with Representative Jensen, and frankly, we'd like to be able to talk to Representative Jensen a little more about his thoughts and his intentions when he got involved with this process. And again, just to echo what Glenn said, the cultural, scientific, and commercial significance, that is current language. That is currently in the statute. What's different is that instead of not listing a species for those reasons, the word remove has been put in. So now we can remove for those reasons. So those weren't things that were thrown in there willy-nilly. That stuff, that was current language. So with that, I'll, if I can answer any questions, I will.
Questions? This dynamic's been going on at least a couple weeks ever since Glenn and you and others were in a work group, and I haven't followed it as closely as you. Just too many bills to keep track of. But this is one where clearly there's been some progress, but there still needs to be more progress. Clarification, some parts that we'd like to see occur. Points 1 and 2 that Warren made. The subjectivity question still bothers me, but I think I understand, comprehend what you're saying. So I do thank you for coming.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead. Can I just add one thing? I realize and I appreciate that the time and effort you put into this personally and your staff to work to bring this thing to closure. But while it isn't perfect, as Greg said, and if we were writing all of this, we'd write it differently, et cetera. But realizing that every bill, every law that's on the books is only a 2-year law because, yeah, you come back, you can change it. The commission, we know the commissioners, we know how the appointment process is done. I would really like to see this bill, if I had my druthers, passed as it came out of the House. Allow the commission to work, and we know it's going to have guidance from the governor's office, it's going to have guidance from the attorney general's office, and allow them to do some things that I would really call common sense, things that need to be done for the people, and actually save a lot of money. It really will.
Thank you. I wish we could just write a bill that says, use common sense.
Yeah, that would be nice.
The last one listed is Martin Taylor on this bill. Is Martin in the room?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, and I'm here today on behalf of the Sierra Club of Oregon. And I guess I'd like to say that I was here to not object to these amendments because in many ways I appreciate the hard work that's gone into crafting these amendments, the degree to which it's been a hard pill for a lot of organizations to swallow. And I would like to tell you that, that's good enough. Unfortunately, you just received a letter from a group of 8 environmental organizations that still have concerns with the bill, even with these amendments, and I'm here to try to explain how we got there. And I may take just a little bit of time because this is a bill that came out of the House very quickly. There wasn't really a public hearing on this portion of the bill. The amendments that are this bill, it was a gut and stuff, arrived at 8 o'clock, and by 8:30 the testimony was over. So this is really the first opportunity that we've had as an environmental community to talk with the legislature about the Endangered Species Act and this bill. I think the first thing that I want to, you know, take into account is that this is a process that can go a lot of ways in the legislature, and I've been part of things that are done at a work group level and behind the scenes. I appreciate that that's sometimes the most effective way of getting good decisions. The Endangered Species Act is a big conversation for Oregonians on either side of the issue. It is one of the very bedrock and foundation pieces of environmental legislation, and to people who care about the environment, it probably is as close to the raw nerve as you can get. And I know that that's probably very true on the other side of the Endangered Species Act as well. But we got here in a way that used some discussions behind the scenes more than discussions in front of the scenes. And I do hope that there's an opportunity at some point to revisit this conversation, if not some other point this session, the next session, because it's a good one. It's an important one. How important is the ESA to environmental groups? I think for environmentalists, there's a belief that you now, as people, as human beings, need to share this planet. And that maybe is a very definition of what it is to have a soul or sentience, right? We're a species, and the only species on the planet, that says, I want to protect the other species around me and not just Darwinistically struggle to survive and get ahead and procreate. We care about other creatures on this planet. That's a good thing. That's something that helps define our humanity. It's also a religiously held belief that Noah put two of every animal on the ark. He didn't say two of every popular animal. He didn't say two of every important or culturally significant or commercially viable animal. He said two of every animal on the ark. And there are still people that take that very literally, and including Sierra Club members. There's actually a group called NOAA that, you know, takes an environmental position from a Christian perspective. And I think that's not irrelevant in our culture, nor is the fact that scientifically we have identified that species have value to us in ways that we can't yet identify. We learn new products that are byproducts of species all the time, and now that we're doing the breakdown of DNA in the human genome, Lord knows what other advances we'll make off of the least likely of the animals that share this planet with us. And obviously the protection of habitat for species is an indicator of the own health of our planet, and ultimately human beings have an invested interest in making sure that this environment will sustain us, not just for the next 10 years, not just until our kids grow up, but, you know, forever. I mean, forever's a long, long time if people want to stick around. And we're growing as a species much more quickly than any other time in human history or any other species on the planet. When we say that animals represent a scientific indicator of how healthy our planet is, that's real, that's survival, that's meaningful. And culturally, I think there's also a question. The reason the Endangered Species Act is so overwhelmingly popular among the public, even though in any specific case people may take objection to, you know, protecting a species in a particular way, the notion that we won't allow species to go extinct is an incredibly popular notion with the public. The reason for it, I think, more than any of these other reasons, is that culturally, we as human beings don't want to take responsibility for something so final as extinction. We're very cautious about doing that, whether it's a religious belief or just sort of a gut check that says, you know what, I don't know that human beings ought to take such a huge responsibility as to forever end another species' existence. That's what we're debating here underneath all this. I know this all comes back to the Oregon Endangered Species Act, and many of these species are not at the brink of extinction. But the fact that they're not at the brink of extinction is because laws like this exist, and that I want to reground us in what we're talking about and why it's so important for environmental folks, and why at times it seems like we're very hard to placate. It's a very big deal to folks who care about the environment. This bill represents three things. First thing it represents is a change in philosophy for the Endangered Species Act from conserving species, sort of that NOAA, you know, make sure two of every animal's okay, but the rest of them are going to get flooded, to a recovery plan, which essentially says we're not just there to make sure that they don't go away, we're actually there to bring them back. Now, that's a great philosophical position. It's also very smart, because we don't want a long list, and we don't want to protect animals forever. We want to get to the point where animals are able to sustain themselves and be secure in the environment so that we don't have to list them, we don't have to protect them, we have to regulate them. But it also represents a second thing. It represents a fairly significant introduction into the elephant in the middle of the room, which is the debate around wolves. And I almost dread saying wolves, because every time you say wolves in this place, people start losing their minds. But it is. Ultimately, a lot of this conversation is about the wolf. A lot of this bill is designed to address concerns and issues around the wolf. And to that extent, what this bill does is it may strengthen the Endangered Species Act for many other species at the expense of the wolf. And even that strengthening for other species is in some ways compromised by things that we're doing to try to get at the wolf question. And third, it's a technical fix for some of the things that aren't working well in the Endangered Species Act, although I think that it would be a mischaracterization to say that that's the primary part of this bill. But some of that is accomplished through this bill, and I think that the testimony that you heard from Mr. Foote is probably very appropriate testimony, that there are some mechanical things that need to be done for the Maine's Endangered Species Act. So there's a couple of good things about this work that has come out in these amendments that I really want to address. I think that taking the political listing and delisting out of the Endangered Species Act is an extremely relevant change. That essentially suggests that Oregon is going to try to use a scientific determination, a biological determination about whether a species is in fact endangered, and at the point in which we think we've recovered it, whether or not a species is in fact recovered, as opposed to putting in things that are essentially non-scientific, but just judgments. What is a politically popular animal and what isn't? I think you've got two steps in this process. The first is to list and delist based on science, and then to determine, based on a whole variety of factors, including impact on human beings, how you recover and how you prioritize your recovery plan. That's the correct way for the Endangered Species Act to be set up. It asks the right questions. We support that. We also support that we did some revision of the original bill on take, including taking out a phrase that said the necessary management of the species. Now, when you're talking about species that are endangered, necessary management is a pretty broad standard for allowing an animal to be taken, and we like that change. On the whole, I think that this is a much better effort, but you know, here's where we still have problems, and I think that it's important to recognize that
page two of the letter now, essentially?
Yeah, I'm going through page two and through the letter. I think that the first thing is that the thing that's supposed to make the environmental community excited about this bill is this recovery plan. It's really not, recovery plan is not defined in the bill anywhere. And, you know, it could just be a semantic change. You could just be taking the word conservation and saying the word recovery, but is there really going to be any practical difference in how the species are managed? And that's a real question, considering that for most of the last 10 years, we've depleted the resources of the agencies in charge of either conservation or recovery. Recovery is presumably a more expensive process. And if we're going any place, we're going to having less, not more, support for these agencies. Likewise, I think that there is a certain feeling, and you know, one of the toughest parts of my job is that I've got 23,000 Sierra Club members, and it feels like half of them have tried to contact me in the last 2 days, all of them with slightly different opinions on this. So I am echoing an opinion that I individually not sure I'm qualified to make, but the opinion that I'm hearing is that they're not sure right now where these agencies are headed, that they had a pretty good understanding of what the job that the previous governor had intended for these agencies, but we're in a transition point where we're not sure what that balance is going to be. And I think that there's just a fundamental lack of belief that, you know, the recovery plans are going to be a huge addition to the Endangered Species Act in practice, where you hit the ground. And that makes it hard to go to them and say, well, let's make some changes that don't advantage the wolf for the advantage of everything else, when they're not sure they're really getting that everything else. Likewise, the political listing is an important change to them philosophically, but this is a political board. ODFNW is a politically appointed body, and it's going to respond to the political pressures that come from this building on their budget and the political pressures that come from the governor on their practices. And so you're going to have some political listing in your listing process, by definition. It would be good to take that criteria out, but I think they were more concerned about adding a political delisting process, because the political delisting process means that when you start recovering a species and you start having positive impact on them, you're also impacting habitat, and at that point, you're impacting people. If every time you start to recover an animal, people come forward and say, this animal is too big a pain in my keister. I just don't want to have to do this anymore. You should delist it because it's not of cultural, scientific, or commercial value, then the very act of trying to protect these animals is putting them in jeopardy. And that's where we're concerned with the delisting process. We need to know that once we've made a commitment to recovering an animal, the things that we do to recover it aren't going to cost it its opportunity to stay on the list. Now, if it's recovered, it should come off the list. I think we agree to that. I think that the wolf in particular becomes an issue in this, and you know, I have some mixed feelings about that personally, because I feel like, you know, we're having an awful lot of time and energy spent on an animal that doesn't live here right now. And if this bill is overall a good change, how much energy should we spend worrying about the fact that there are some things designed to make the wolf's reintroduction to Oregon more difficult? I'll tell you that Sierra Club members care very much about the wolf, and that I am responsive to them, and that they have some real concerns in this area. The first, and it's in the letter, I'm not going to read the entire letter to you, but I'm going to tick them off. The first and foremost of all of them is that this would allow an animal to be listed, delisted, if it's secure outside the state of Oregon, which the wolf currently is. And they believe that that entire attribute of taking secure outside the state is intended to essentially delist the wolf. And then lower its protected status in the state, making it more difficult for it to be repopulated. There's also some specific provisions around take. There's no protection in the take provision around trying to do conflict avoidance or mitigation, which has been successfully done in wolf management plans in other states. It reintroduces the 4D rule, which is basically federal law. And the 4D rule is currently being contested in court by the Defenders of Wildlife. It's a suit that's open and ongoing. And, you know, the feeling is that it's a pretty deliberate attempt to tie into something that is very controversial policy at the federal level. And I think that there's also, in the protection of human beings, it's great. We should definitely have that addition. I mean, I kind of agree with Glenn Stonebrink on this one. It should be, you know, a non-issue that if you're threatened by a wolf, you should be able to shoot it. If you're threatened by any, if, you know, if a wild salmon or the spotted owl is coming after you, you know, for, you know, shoot at it. I mean, I have no problem with that. But I think that the provisions that are in the federal ESA are correct provisions, which require the reporting and a follow-up investigation when a take happens of an endangered species. And this is well-grounded. Originally, a lot of these species became endangered because the spotted owl feathers, sorry, the bald eagle feathers were worth a lot, or people wanted to hunt buffalo because they were, you know, a great industry, or whales were hunted for, so it was a great industry, or wolves were hunted because they were a nuisance. We've deliberately taken animals for a long time. This essentially says, before we can assume that you took these animals for a correct reason, we need to get some sort of a report that you did it, and that an investigation was followed up to make sure that it was appropriate, that you took it in the correct circumstances. That's federal law. It should be state law as well. And then there's the unintended consequences of doing these kinds of things to get at the issue of wolves to other animals. The secure outside the state standard is very troubling to environmental groups for two reasons that have nothing to do with the wolf. If you say that an animal is secure outside the state and then you can stop listing it, you're essentially starting Oregon in a path of the race to the bottom with other states. If all states did this, essentially, whatever state had a healthy animal population would then become responsible for it, not just for its own state, but for everybody else around it. It's essentially saying Oregon's got no responsibility to protect an animal that's safe in another state. We're going to leave that entire charge to the other state. That's a concern. Probably the greater concern here is that habitat's not so easy and convenient and friendly, that if you're a, you know, a migratory bird, there's not going to be a sign that says, you know, if you want on land, you should probably do it in Washington because you're safe there, but we don't protect you in Oregon. If you're a salmon, you don't make a distinction between, you know, the north and south side of the Columbia River. If we say, if you're secure salmon populations in Washington, the salmon don't know they can't come to Oregon and be safe because we've delisted them because of this provision. I think that whether it's, you know, wildlife corridors, migratory patterns of animals, flight patterns, you have to consider that there are many circumstances where Oregon's ecosystem is essential to the continued security of an animal in another state's ecosystem. And to simply say, because you're secure over there, we're not going to protect you, actually endangers that animal both in Oregon and in the other state. I guess what I'm trying to say is, on balance, we came into this process hoping to be able to work with all parties involved and to find something that would work, and I know you've made a great effort, and I wish that we could reward that effort with our support, but we can't. There's still too many unanswered questions, and the issue is just too raw. This isn't a place that you get to fudge on the edges. The Sierra Club members would string me up if I did it, so I need to be very clear. This is, at this point, not a piece of work.
Don't motivate us. I know.
Where do we send the rope?
So some of you rolling your eyes going, man, this is our opportunity.
Hey, this is a great chance. Don't watch where you're going there. Yes.
We need to say that on balance there's more harm than good.
We don't fudge on the edges and we follow up every take. Yeah. I could keep you busy in Douglas County on the whitetail, Columbia whitetail deer that are killed by the automobiles. Yeah. You're going to do stuff like that. There's got to be some common sense in this thing.
Well, Senator Fisher, I agree, and I will continue to search with you for that common sense, and when there are appropriate times for me to push back on my membership, I will. I think that I'm trying to bring some concerns that still do reflect common sense, but I understand that there needs to be some boundaries, too.
Thank you, Martin. Are there other questions? Well, so far I've heard Glenn say that there's good things. Greg say the Farm Bureau wouldn't get in the way, but it was not real enthusiastic. Martin say he's against. Warren had a couple good points at the beginning. Nobody has addressed too well my concern about subjectivity in the bill. And most important, Representative Jensen isn't here. He's at a funeral. I guess that's tomorrow, isn't it? Or is that today?
Yesterday.
Oh, yesterday. I think we're rushing if we go forward at this point, and I'm not so sure that there aren't some other alternatives to getting to the issues that can be addressed in the bill. So I'm at this point, I'm not ready to support it. That's... other discussions? Any of you?
How many more meetings do you anticipate having, Mr. Chair?
It's interesting you would say that, because one of our fearless leaders here, when I said, well, last meeting this morning, he was walking down the hall with me, and he said, not necessarily. So... for the moment, I feel like we're running out of time, and I want to get on to the Commodity Commission bill and the aggregate mining bill.
I like the original bill. I'm willing to support the Dash 5 to keep the bill moving forward. And I believe Representative Jensen would non-concur, and the bill would go into a conference committee, and the bill, it could be continued to be worked at that point in time, but you've got the hammer.
Yeah, I do. And I'm not going to use it except to close this hearing, and I'm going to open a hearing on the Commodity Commission Senate Bill 854 at this point. It's not scheduled for a hearing. You're right. It's just, so it's a work session that we're opening. But I do want to ask Dave Nelson or Richard Whitman to come up and explain the Dash 5 amendments one more time, just because we love hearing about this bill so much. And we haven't spent enough time on it yet.
Mr. Dewey and Mr. McCauley and Shannon O'Fallon will explain the technical amendments. We'll back up.
Okay. It can be a chorus effort as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Commodity Commission Consortium, and thank you for providing us the opportunity to have a work session.
Would you say that again? Commodity Commission Consortium?
Consortium.
I want to see.
Is it a coordinated consortium?
It's a coordinated Commodity Commission Consortium.
CCC.
It's the four C.
And we do thank you for the opportunity to have a work session and discuss a consensus that we think we have arrived at on Senate Bill 854. Mr. McCauley shortly will provide you with the highlights of the modifications from the original bill. And Ms. O'Fallon is here if you have any technical questions, I assume, on the legal front. A few months ago, you heard about the importance of commodity commissions. They have worked exceedingly well in the past 60 years in the area of promotion, research, the extension of the research, and in the last 10 years, you've heard about the environmental research in the area of pesticides, water, and the like, recognizing the Oregon Plan, the Salmon Plan, and those kinds of opportunities and concerns. You also heard from the representatives from the AG that they believe, and we believe, that commodity commissions have some concerns with regard to their statutes and the constitutionality in the area of the First Amendment and the area of the delegation issue. And you heard about two Supreme Court decisions that basically got the AG to that opinion. And they have I would say, you know, kind of unfortunately for us, provided a roadmap for potential lawsuits down the road. That was inevitable as we had these discussions. And Mr. Chair had asked at one point in time for us to provide to him the outreach that we have provided the various commodity commissions to the members that pay the assessment to assure them that this is an issue, and we wanted to have a frank discussion about how they wanted to deal with commodity commissions in the future. And part of that issue was over refunds, it was about promotion and those kinds of things. So you had a four-plus-hour hearing a few months ago, and you heard that there was some opposition to
the... I thought that was 40. Never mind.
I was on a plane to D.C. at the time, and I was very thankful to be doing that. But I'm very thankful to be up here today. Let me say that the Farm Bureau had presented some concerns, and we had had some numerous discussions with the Farm Bureau and the individuals that we represent, and we have reached, I believe, a consensus. We do not believe that there is any fiscal impact, although this bill has a referral to Ways and Means, and our hope is that it would be sent to the floor today, and that referral would be rescinded. And I say that because we've had discussions with the representatives from the Department of Agriculture, and with regard to the original bill and the oversight in the promotion area, arguably there could have been a significant fiscal. But we have put some sideboards on that and changed that, so we do not believe that there is a fiscal. It would not require any additional employees at the department. But if you need further evidence of that or a concern, then we can ask the department to come forward. So, Mr. Chair, what we thought we would do is very briefly have Mr. McCulley explain to you the significant differences.
Can we define briefly? Never mind. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCulley representing the Commodity Commission Consortium, I guess is what we're called now. Before you, I hope, has been distributed this one-page sheet that lists the agreements that have been reached in the Dash 5 amendments that are before you.
Chair, I have to ask a question.
And that's going to be the basis for what I'm going to say.
Well, Senator Beyer has a question first.
I just need to know how you got it in one page with the amendments due. It took Judith five pages.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Collins did a wonderful job of summarizing the entire bill of, 78 pages. My comments deal only with the areas of compromise that were reached within the bill. And many of the changes required in the bill came when the decision was made in agreeing with what the Oregon Cattlemen's Association had recommended, and that being that the Oregon Beef Council statutes be continued as they are and stand alone. So many of the changes in the Dash 5 amendments include restating the Oregon Beef Council statutes and the Oregon Wheat Commission statutes with the changes that are generally made to the other Commodity Commission statutes. Okay? So that's a major change that is included in why the amendments are so thick. What I'm going to describe for you very briefly, Mr. Chair, are the main areas of compromise reached on the other parts of the bill. And those start with the additional government oversight provisions in the bill. And there were two primary areas of government oversight. One, where we added additional requirements to the Oregon Department of Agriculture in reviewing commodity commission programs. And the other part was the public member serving on commodity commissions. The agreement is that those provisions will sunset, and they will sunset on March 1st, 2009. And you see sections 5 and 6 of the Dash 5 amendments, as well as sections 29 and 30 of the Dash 5 amendments. Those parts of the bills will sunset on March 1st, 2009. Another compromise reached is in the area of pesticides. There is a laundry list of issues, things that commodity commissions can do. There was concern about a provision that would allow commodity commissions to be involved in the re-registration of pesticides, that that might also include the ability of commodity commissions to regulate pesticide usage. So in Section 8, page 7, lines 19 and 20, we have clarified that the commodity commissions may not regulate the use of pesticides. In the previous hearing, you heard a lot about refunds. We reached an agreement in this part of the bill where we would conduct a survey of all commodity commission producers, those who pay assessments to commodity commissions, and that survey would include a specific question about refunds. And another part of that provision would be that the results of the survey would have to be provided to the producers. So that's another compromise that was reached.
The results would, you said, quote unquote, have to be provided. Does that mean they're going to be published in their newsletters, or do you have to write in, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to get them? What do you do?
Mr. Chair, that is not specified in the amendments. It just says that I believe they have to be made available to the producers. So commodity commissions will have a variety of options, listing it, I suppose, on a website, including it in a newsletter. There are various ways that that could be accomplished. The other thing I need to point out is Section 12, which is on page 9, lines 29 and 30, and page 10, lines 1 to 4. There was a concern about if the legislature abolishes a commodity commission, what would happen to any funds that are remaining in that commission. The original language in Senate Bill 854 would have had those funds go to Oregon State University for research programs that would benefit the producers of that commodity. An additional subsection has been added that would allow those funds to be refunded to the payers of those assessments that created the amount of money that would be remaining upon dissolution of a commission. That's another option that the commission would have in addition to providing the funds to Oregon State. Mr. Chair, those are the primary areas. The rest of my sheet lists shows you the Beef Council and Oregon Wheat Commission changes that were as a result of an agreement on the Beef Council side with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. And I'd be happy to answer any questions at this point.
Anybody have questions? Shannon, do you have some testimony you want to share locally here?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Shannon O'Fallon with the Attorney General's Office. I'm just here to answer any specific questions people might still have about the legal issue, so I don't have any specific testimony.
Okay. I suppose this is as good as any time to point this out. I have a letter from a guy named Phil Olson, in case you've never met him. And it ends with the statement, please be advised and make no statement mistake about it. I am willing to follow a course of legal action to recover past years' assessments should 854 become law without individual producer refund options for the future.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Luckily, all the attorneys in the state are going to be working on the PERS lawsuit.
Okay. Thank you for addressing all my concerns on that subject. I just wanted to read that into the record.
Mr. Chair, again, Mike Dewey, we have had substantial discussions about potential lawsuits. And as a matter of fact, and Ms. O'Fallon can speak to this better than I can, the state of Washington has passed a similar law looking at our draft legislation, hopefully complete legislation at some point in time, feeling that that does protect the commodity commissions. And as you know, they had a significant problem because of the Apple Commission going out of business and now being able to get back into business. But we've had that conversation. And we addressed that with some commodity commissions. But most of the commodity commissions chose not to provide for a refund, albeit we have the survey, and that's going to tell us something down the road. we're taking the advice of council, and council believes that we have a system in place once this bill passes that will protect these particular commodity commissions if and when there's litigation. But we don't know, and we'll find out after this bill passes, hopefully.
Other questions or comments? Thank you all.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Whether we can lift them or not, there are some Dash 5 amendments that need to be moved.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendments in the Senate Bill 854.
And that's all 78 pages of them.
Exactly.
Okay. Are there questions or...
specific one you like us to delete.
It's found on page 57.
I don't like Article 93 of this.
Yeah.
Never liked it.
Any questions, comments? I'm going to have us vote on this. Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 854. If there's no questions, would the clerk call the roll on this one?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
I want him to be game mammals.
Aye. We've adopted the Dash 5, so...
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 854 as amended to the floor and ask the Senate President to remove or rescind the Ways and Means Referral, a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 854 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. That's what you said.
That's exactly what I said, Mr. Chair. Not quite as eloquently as you did.
Okie dokie. Well, I thank Judith for that. Is there any discussion? If not, would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. Senate Bill 854, as amended, is moved to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation. I will say, for the guys that are walking out the door, I expect lots of fun and even some surprises on the House side. And with that, we're going to open... Oh, you need a carrier. You want
to carry
this?
You'd like me to carry
it. I am so surprised that you would want to carry this. Senator Byer.
I didn't want to. I said I will.
You didn't say you wanted to? Okay. We're going to open a work session.
This is a work session.
We're going to open a work session only on House Bill 3013. And is Bob Arindi here?
Yeah, he's there.
Yes. He's the guy that we need to explain the Dash 4 amendments.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Rindy. I'm with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. What I try to do with the Dash 4 amendments is the bill itself was intended to be a bill that put back, I guess is one way to say it, put back the process to the way it was before the LUBA case on Beaver State. That case had the effect of taking away the conditional use process, which has been used for many decades to approve aggregate sites. 3013 in its original form was purported to be sort of putting it back to status quo, but many people have testified to you and to us that it didn't exactly do that. So I tried to write, and I believe I've succeeded in writing an amendment that simply does that, simply says what I know counties have been doing for a long time. Currently the problem here is that we have a term in the statute, which is the term is inventory, and it's undefined. And that was the basis of the Beaver State case, was LUBA decided what that term meant. And we don't think they got that right, at least if you look at the history. So I tried to write a definition for that term that I think represents past practice.
Okay. as you've gone through this, on page one of the dash fours, section one, sub two, lines 10 and 11.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the top of page two, four, sub four, A and B. And then section three.
Mr. Chair, on page one, lines 10 and 11, that's existing statute. The original bill had taken that out. This would put it back in.
Yeah.
The definition is what I proposed on page two. Page three was not my proposal. That's a sunset. That says that this repair is good for 2 years.
Right. And I understand that there's serious problems with putting the sunset on the bill. But what's amazing to me, and it really is, and I want to congratulate the aggregate folks. I wish that Rich were in the room. I'd like to personally congratulate him. And Don, I want to congratulate you. You guys have done a lot of work. Bob, I want to thank you. And some people have done some serious negotiations on this bill. My issue is not to come out of this particular bill popular or whatever, but to come out of this bill with what I see a real just resolution for all parties. And so it's my intent that the bill go to the floor and then it'll end up in a conference committee, because I believe that the way the parties have been negotiating, we're going to get some more time at the conference committee level to finish out what I think is a tremendous start. I was reading someplace this morning. Oh, yeah, in my packet I have a bunch of letters on the bill, and it was just interesting to me that the first two or three of them all had the little town near here, Turner, in them. And it had something about trucks through the town and stuff. And I was in Washington earlier this week and talked with a couple U.S. senators from Oregon. And it's significant that they, you know, as we've talked about this bill and it's gone around, it's not central to this bill, but them talking to Burlington Northern and UP and maybe making the possibility that we use rail instead of the highway system for movement of this aggregate in certain situations make a lot of difference to a lot of people. So not only the mainstream, the hard work at the center of it, but even some of the spin-off stuff has been very worthwhile. And for that reason, I want us to move it as is amended here and continue, I think, some really good faith work that's been going on between Rich and Don and several others. It's interesting, the room is pretty empty now, but this is the bill I think we've spent more time. I've been in more pits and more farms. And
oh, he's just bored. Yeah, he drops in. He likes hearing him be. Yeah. He was in here last night till 6 o'clock.
No kidding.
Yeah. He thought this was they were going to build a baseball field out of the aggregate park.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that'd be a good idea, actually.
It was not a bad idea.
Is there any room for baseball diamonds in any of these pits? I mean, you know.
Wait, you recover an aggregate
park? We can put bleachers around the edge of one of these.
A baseball diamond in one.
Mr. Chair, are you talking about making that a farm use?
Before we go any farther with this, I just want to thank you. Are there any questions? I think we know what we're doing. We are in work session. I need an amendment.
Move the dash, whatever it is.
Dash fours.
That four amendment.
Dash four amendments have been moved. Are there any questions or discussion?
Well, I have some discussion. I want to clarify that Senator Metzger is not here for any way, shape, or form for baseball. He is here to learn how a committee is run appropriately. Unfortunately, he missed the committee.
As I was saying before I was so rudely interrupted, the clerk is going to call the roll on the dash four amendments, which have been moved.
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Byer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. The Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3013 have been approved.
Move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Byer moves House Bill 3013 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Byer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. Senate House Bill 3013 as amended has been approved. Since Senator Byer has the joy of carrying 854, I will have the unparalleled joy of carrying House Bill 3013.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fisher.
Just a caution. When you talk about trucks interrupting life on the road, don't think that railroads are totally interruptive of life as they rumble and jumble and jiggle everybody that they pass, including through the cities and everywhere else. So it's a bit of a trade-off.
I do understand that, being one that lived for a long time, just on the other side of 12th Street.
I think we're getting off track here.
We don't want to derail the bill. At this point, it's been approved, and I'm going to adjourn this committee before we do anything else.
One more, Brian.